black dolls, black, black dolls. Hard on the heels of this kind of poetry develops, inevitably, an aesthetic of African poetry which demands that the African poetic landscape be no more than, quote, a landscape of elephants, beggars, calabashes, serpents, pumpkins, baskets, town criers, iron belts, slit drums, iron masks, snakes, squirrels. A landscape portrayed with native eyes to which aeroplanes naturally appear as iron birds. A landscape in which the animals behave as they might behave in African folklore of animals presented through native African eyes. This delimitation of the African poetic province has been set by self-avowed African critics, products of this living generation, black, not by a Hollywood scriptwriter of the 40s. We have a name for them, not easy to forget, not difficult to guess, the Neo-Tarzanists. And therein lies the story. Because it is invariably, as it is in this case, that quotation which I've just given, it is invariably the uprooted, the culturally alienated, who turn back to the roots with the fierceness of the long deprived and with its corresponding ignorance. Well, perhaps ignorance is an inaccurate word. They do know something. They know Tarzan of the Apes, and they have an abject conditioning coated in intellectual licorice from the legacy of Hegel, Gobineau, Human Company. Lacking the resources to challenge such elevated ignorance, they take refuge in glorifying the cultural retardation which has been assigned them as their maximal development, turning it into a principled aesthetic. Leon Damas, of course, I must be fair to everybody, he of course wrote far more accomplished poems than that unfortunate example. And the major negritudinists did later gracefully modify their position, acknowledging their original stance to be nothing more than a phase, a reaction, the erection of a combative banner. The pitfalls of the school of poetry committed simply the fundamental error of imagining that they had willed their position, and that this position, which to the racist view of civilization is negative, could, by dint of their creative will, by their act of celebration, be turned into a positive virtue. Reason is Greek, emotion African, claimed Leopold Sédar Senghor at the height of the negritudinist fervor. And translating this Hegelian position into a pen of self-reduction, a pen to self-reduction, to the vitiation not merely of the whole man, but of the whole history of man, of all men, Aimé Césaire, alas, also rhapsodized his unfortunate corroboration of the thesis of David Hume, hurrah for those who never invented anything. What would they have made of the program of Johannes R. Beecher, who in his own expressionist deviation swore not only to invent the swiftest aeroplane, think up the most phenomenal automobile, prove Fermat's last theorem, discover new poles, yet went on to declare that is all this 15 years before negritude in his introduction to my new book of verse, quote, Negro tribes, fever, tuberculosis, venereal epidemics, intellectual psychic defects, I'll fight them, vanquish them. Analysis, analysis, analysis. Island of despair, you'll vanish. Ithaca's, not this one, silvery shores are shimmering. O thou island of pure deliverance. Reconcile that effusion, whoever can, with reason is Greek, emotion African. The expressionist movement was filled, like negritude, with its own contradictions. For some of the negritudinists, of course, Leopold Sédar Senghor especially, the ambivalence of their literary product went beyond a mere entrapment in the dialectics of the master race. France held a mystic hold on them, like Rabia Ravelo, who was never part of the movement, a hold which was translated wherever they attained political power into political and socioeconomic strategies that bordered on race treachery. There's no place to go into those aspects, especially as the examples of most other non-Francophone, non-negritudinist, negritude-oriented ex-colonial territories indicate that the differences have been only a matter of style and degree, the result being, with near uniformity, a second expropriation of the African masses, a continuation of the experience of slavery in different forms, of dehumanization and neocolonial exploitation under a new set of hobnail boots. By the way, I hear that Sergeant Doe has got his. I hope it's true. It is the poetry of Senghor which fascinates one, so full of a studied resonance that which almost seduces one to the claims of negritudinist inspiration, only to repel by the nature of the content. Women of France, and you, daughters of France, give me leave to sing of you. For you, the clear notes of the sarong, take them, though their rhythm is barbarous and their harmony harsh, like a peasant's milk and his coarse bread, pure in his clumsy, calloused hand. You, beautiful trees, upright under the shelling and the bombs, the only arms in days of despondency, in days of panic, despair, proud towers, proud steeples, under the arrogance of the sun in June, clear echo to the cry of the Gallic cock. Barbarous rhythm, harsh harmony, clumsy, callous hands, as opposed to beautiful trees, proud towers, proud steeples. Why? Even Frobenius accepted a classic loveliness in Ife Bronzes. Alas, Leopold Sédar Senghor is the true griot with a false vocation. As a nature poet, an open-air sensibility in whose veins the seasons of Black Africa run their course with animistic ease. Every breeze trills his tongue in epical tones, the heroic tonalities of the born griot. He paints with bold strokes, delineating the shades and highlights of experience, spraying on the patina of the eternal, of the secured communal and ancient realities. His incantations stretch the transient moments and emotions to rouse the ancients in their homes, joining the spiritual to the sensuous. Young girls with upright breasts, sing the rise of the sap, proclaim the spring. A drop of water has not fallen for 6 months, not a tender word, not a budding smile. Only the fierceness of the hamatan, like the fangs of the viper. At best, only a swell of the sand, only the whirlwind of dust and straws and rubbish and wing sheaths. Dead things under the fierce erosion of reason. Only the east wind in our throats, like the cisterns of the desert, dry. But this clamor in our limbs, this rousing of the sap, swelling the buds at the groin of the young men, working the pearl oyster beneath the mangroves. Maidens, listen to the song of the sap rising to your upright throat. This is a Senghor we prefer to remember. The one we wish someone would award the Nobel Prize for Literature so the rest of African writers can rest in peace for the next 20 years. That's for you. Well, we've touched on two strategies, two forms of reactions. The reductionist context of negritude, the other being the iconoclastic, that is Yambo Olugwem's, which cries a plague on both your houses, the other house being the Islamic, because Olugwem is equally unsparing of the Islamic world, which he had judges to be just as guilty of active destruction and denigration of the African world, its cultures, and its sociopolitical integrity. This view, unpalatable though it is, to many promoters of a unified third world, does happen to be a truthful view of a pattern that began with the earliest Islamic invasion of the black Egyptian world in the 7th century AD. Mangubeti, on his part, the poor Christ of Bomba, etc., employs a subtler wit, but no less effective in his demolition and act on Europe's Christian union to the civilizing mission. With these writers, in common with Sembene Usman, Alex Laguma, the South African Marxist writer, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, Aikwe Arma, Lenri Peters, and a host of other African writers, it is difficult to find any trace of that kind of nostalgia for the Western world, which sometimes, admittedly, provides a creative tension in the literature of negritude, but generally attenuates a conviction in its internal cultural security. Writers of the ambivalent strain embrace nearly all negritudinists. Even when the subject matter is the assertion of a tangible self-validation, the overall response which their works evoke, the poetry especially, is, methinks the lady doth protest too much. At the bottom of the spectrum, way, way down below even the primal child syndrome, is the aesthetic of infantile regression, already referred to, one which holds up, just one example, the following verse, in print, believe it or not, as the truthful and authentic voice of the African poetic muse, and confronts those who call them buffoons with the opportunistic flag of cultural decolonization. In our little village, when elders are around, boys must not look at girls, and girls must not look at boys, because the elders say that is not good. End of verse. There is yet, however, another genre of writing, one which seizes wholeheartedly on the factual basis of African reality, but insists that it must be interrogated through a conscious ideological framework. An unmediated past, accepted as such, it claims, leads inevitably to a rationalization of social systems and beliefs, however reactionary, and writers like Sembene Ousmane, and more recently, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and lesser known ones like Femi Osofiso in Nigeria, Niyi Oshundare, also in Nigeria, have engaged such assumptions creatively, either by providing contrasting social ideological options in the midst of social upheaval, as in Sembene, or like Ngugi, exposing the inherent contradictions which became structured into the spoils, the state of the spoils of victory, the appropriation of exploitative colonial structures by a new class, the true beneficiaries of what had been a massed anti-colonial struggle. This specific ideological thrust, overtly stated or actively induced from the interplay of characters and situations, has lately become prominent, into the service of which past mythologies and hero concepts, once taken for granted, are restructured through a Marxist framework. The results are naturally varied. On the one hand, there's the extreme ultra-leftism, which commits the same sin of non-analytical indifference as the mythifiers, denying on their own part any virtues of progressive potential to the past. One such critic, a foreigner, earning his living in Mahon University in the philosophy department, interesting how philosophy appears to breed the most racially warped of commentators in the African world, this neo-humist actually dismisses the material of the African past as, I quote, cracked, chipped, and useless pieces of antique porcelain. Elsewhere in the same essay, this critic insists that it is the duty of African writers to treat traditional thought systems in terms of false consciousness. It is a credit to the liberal traditions of my university, in particular, that such a scholar is still permitted to earn a living on African soil. However, some African writers in themselves, as I've stated, have begun to write their own history through the spectrum of class analysis, or to be more accurate, set out to do so, to carry out this laudable intent. Briefly, I will mention one using the play Moron Todun by one of the younger generation of writers, Femi Osofiso, what constitutes some of the pitfalls of this exercise. The play Moron Todun is about Moremi, a historic and at the same time mythologized character, who's been the subject of many playwrights, traditional playwrights, most notably Duro Ladipo. Her story is straightforward enough. Bothered by the continuing incursions of the Igbo people against her own country and kingdom, in the present Ondo area, she disguised, she allowed herself to be captured by the Igbo invaders in order to penetrate their secrets. Anytime the Igbo came, their appearance was so terrifying that the defenders of the city simply dropped their weapons and fled. So she was captured, and she was so beautiful, she was married by one of the commanders of the Igbo army and had children for her. When she found out the secret, found out that it was in fact human beings who masked themselves and used makeup to such terrifying, representing supernatural beings, she left the Igbo and returned to her own country. Naturally, when the Igbo people came around again, the Ondo people were waiting. Now, Femi Osofiso takes this myth and translates it, uses it as a kind of means to critique, to portray yet another event which took place, in fact, quite recently, the Agbekoya peasant uprising in the Western region. In this, in his own version, the Moremi of the play, of the Agbekoya uprising, is the daughter of a wealthy trader and is captured by the Agbekoya. She sees herself there as the reincarnation of Moremi. She sees Moremi in her dreams, flashbacks, the flashback scenes, and so on and so forth. And finally, she falls in love, of course, and with the leader, and realizes that her mission, in fact, is to understand the condition of the revolutionaries. So she joins them. In other words, a kind of Patricia Hearst syndrome. Now, what Femi Oshofisen does is to make the current, the contemporary Moremi, interrogate the original, the historic Moremi, and she decides that that Moremi, in fact, was not a heroine at all, but that her act was based on pure self-interest, a wish to retain, to perpetuate the domination of her class over the masses. Now, this is in fact a valid thesis, but only on the surface. And only if one is prepared to join in a different vein in the game of traducing one's history for ideological gains. If Oshofisen had been content to use the Moremi theme as base for examining the class genesis and conflicts of the Agbekoye uprising specifically, and Nigerian society in general, the issue would be more straightforward. We would have, as I've said, a kind of Patricia Hearst saga with an unarguable ideological resolution. From the moment of the capture, the dialectical process begins when the initial shock and the subjective, that is, conditioned reaction, is passed. The individual objectively assesses the antithetical product of his or her privileged existence as manifested in the reality of the captor's existence of absolute commitment and self-sacrifice. Action results, which could be either the result of intellectual conviction, reorientation, the result of re-education, or again, thanks to the individual psychology as a product of fantasizing. The problem of converting historic myths to structures which in effect negate the values, the virtues, which they had at the particular time of their origination, of course, is the problem of trying to acquire, in many cases, a kind of ideological respectability. It ends up with throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I do not know if Lady Godiva, because if we wish to reinterpret myths, we can reinterpret Lady Godiva's action on behalf of the peasants, by just an attempt to feed the peasants on panacea, to keep them quiet, in order to perpetuate the class structure of her oppressive, which is ruled over by her oppressive husband, and of which she's a participant. Her action, in fact, does nothing towards breaking the mold of class structure, privilege, and expropriation of the serfs, which existed at the time. The problem, in fact, is part and parcel, in a different way, of the dilemma of trying to universalize, whether ideologically or culturally, or in terms of intellectual philosophic specifics, trying to universalize one's heritage. The problem existed, as I said earlier, the dilemma very much for people like Aimé Césaire, who in fact joined the Communist Party, and after some years left it, declaring, again, rather embarrassedly, "I'm now convinced that our ways and those of communism do not blend." That is quite an extreme position for him to take after the initial conviction. "We colored men have become aware of our entire range of uniqueness, the uniqueness of our condition in the world, which can be compared with no other. Both the political and cultural paths are not ready-made. They are still to be discovered, and the route to this discovery must be ours alone." Others, of course, within the movement made a clear choice from the very beginning. In short, it is best, I think, in the case of the transformation of heroic themes in mythology, not simply to sacrifice them on the altar of ideological universalism, but to situate the dilemma in its own thematic terms, in the words of Bertolt Brecht, "Unhappy the land that has no heroes, unhappier still the land that has need of heroes." That resolves the ideological dilemma. But we cannot afford to end on yet another playwright of some ambivalence, for Brecht himself was not entirely free of this in his works, and most specifically for our purpose, in Baal, that moisture deity of probably Mesopotamian and further back North African ancestry, whom Brecht exhumed to close the torrid chapter of expressionist excesses, and who, in a way, also symbolizes the extremes of the negritude movement. For those who insist that Bell was a satire on the raging beast of the Nietzschean awakening of that movement, it is necessary only to ask that they look closely at the poetry of that dramatic progression of the amoral Superman. Certainly the portrait of Bell is not meant to be anything but repellent, but such nature lyricism in the service of establishing the credentials of depravity, in capital letters, does not emerge from a total vacuum in attraction or fascination. But we cannot really delve into that now, into the intestines of that most intriguing play. I propose, therefore, simply to give Ulugwem, Yambo Ulugwem, the iconoclast, the last word. For me, his poem Tomatoes sums up the satirical wisdom of those figures also. We've touched only on their virtues of self-apprehension and symbolic repletion, not so much on their silent, cosmic laughter and creative mockery, virtues which their mortal creators are the first to acknowledge and exemplify. A virtue, I might add, which the European expressionists and their negritudinist counterparts appeared to lack in any remedial sense. So let Ulugwem redress the balance and at the same time annihilate with its mordant wit the entire history of racist literature and propositions and the ambivalent need of those literatures it has provoked, consciously, unconsciously, into being in the strategies of refutation, veering from the willed imperatives of specificity to the folds of universalism and back, exploiting but negating their own myths and history, courting and shying away from ideologies. I think the world womb of our nimber presences must be near premature delivery from the, no pun intended, belly laughs produced by these surrealist lines whose cannibal joke is this time on the alien humorist. The poem is Tomatoes. People think I'm a cannibal, but you know what people say. People see I've got red gums, but who has white ones? Up the tomatoes. People say there are not nearly so many tourists now, but you know this isn't America and nobody has the money. People think it's my fault and are scared, but look, my teeth are white, not red. I've not eaten anybody. People are rotten. They say I scoff baked tourists, or maybe grilled. Baked or grilled, I asked. They don't say anything, just keep looking uneasily at my gums. Up the tomatoes. Everyone knows in an agricultural country there's agriculture. Up the vegetables. Everyone knows that vegetables, well, you can't live on the vegetables you grow, and that I'm quite well developed for someone underdeveloped. Miserable scum living off the tourists, down with my teeth. People suddenly surrounded me, tied me up, threw me down at the feet of justice. Cannibal or not cannibal, answer. Ah, you think you are so clever, so proud of yourself. Well, we'll see. I'm going to settle your account. Have you anything to say before you are sentenced to death? I shouted, up the tomatoes. People are rotten, and women curious, you know. There was one of these in the curious circle. In her rasping voice, sort of bubbling like a saucepan with a hole in it, shrieked, slit open his belly. I'm sure father is still inside. There weren't any knives, naturally enough, among the vegetarians of the Western world. So they got a Gillette blade and carefully slit, slat, flop, slit open my belly. Inside, flourishing rows of tomatoes watered by streams of palm wine. Up the tomatoes. Thank you.
I've only read reviews of the Bright Prize, I must confess. I mean, very simply because I don't consider Buche Emecheta a very exciting writer. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that. But I will read it now, so I'll be prepared in the future.
something that can be said in defense of your philosophical colleague.
In the defense of what?
Of your philosophical colleague, if you say, or your ex-colleague, which is that I think at least part of what this person had in mind was that it's a mistake to defend traditional religious ideas just because they're ours, just because they belong to us, and that we should ourselves be willing to say, as Christian philosophers, philosophers in Christian culture should be willing to say, and philosophers in Jewish culture and Islamic culture should be willing to say, this is an important part of our heritage, it has formed us, we must understand it, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll agree with that, absolutely. I mean, for me, the process of analysis, of re-examination, even in terms of the development of all society, it must be a continuous one. But this quote, when I use that quotation, it was really not taken out of context, in essence. It was part of a whole fight, of some of which you're aware, which had been going on in the philosophy department of IFE, which actually began in Accra when I was there, and carried over to the philosophy department, and we got more and more acerbic. And of course, there are, there's no question at all that all religions, all philosophical systems have bugbears which have to be ironed out. And the argument of the other side of the argument in IFE, I beg your pardon, the position of the other side in, the, in IFE, in fact, had to do with the fact that the whole process of philosophic teaching in African universities had been one of total dismissal, you know, just superstition as opposed to quote-unquote philosophy. And this really was the context from which this one was taken.
I think the critique you made of that position should be applied to work in the Frankfurt tradition as well, by, for example, in Donji, who seems to me, where he has many good points to make. I believe the lack in the sense of the point of trying to articulate and develop traditional ideas. He just wants to be.
Yes. Totally, precisely. This is part of the situation. There's no dialectic process going on between reality, between heritage, history, and the theoretical system, which all this, you know, which dismisses all this outright. There's no. So it's this lack of contact, this lack of the argumentative process, which they just a framework is accepted, and once that framework, nothing, anything which doesn't fit into it is dismissed. And they do not even know what doesn't fit into it because they have not taken the trouble to explore. And this is really the criticism which one makes. Then on the other side, of course, there are exaggerations. I mean, as you know very well, that somebody who tried to suggest that some, I think it was, I've forgotten his name, Makinde, who tried to, yes, it was he, suggest that there was an empirical mathematical principle embedded in the Ifa system of divination. People have been working on that for a long time. I personally, much as I hold with Ifa and its role in society, in its poetry, its metaphors, I think that one can go too far and try and equate Ifa with the quadratic equation, which in fact has been the position of some of them.
If you have more questions, let me invite you all for refreshments in the AE White House, and thank Arthur Yanko again.